In the culture wars, there are no winners, just podcasters. Only a few are willing to risk their lives in the face of some of the dumbest ideas to have ever captured human civilization. Every week, we, Megan Dahm and Sarah Hayter, humbly accept this mission to bring you conversations that are equal parts stunning, brave, and one of nine different personality types. Welcome to a special place in hell. Or maybe we're two different personality types. So do you know what your Enneagram type is, Sarah?
I do not.
Okay. I don't either, but I'm about to find out. So I had to take this Enneagram test recently for something that I'm doing. And I'm going to open the results.
We have to tell them what they
in
what
real
it
time.
Is.
I'm going to tell them what it is. I'm going to tell them what it is. I don't know what it is. Okay. So the Enneagram is a model of the human psyche, which is principally understood and taught as a typology of nine interconnected personality types. Okay, so the origin and history of ideas, it's disputed, shockingly. Contemporary approaches are principally derived from the teachings of the Bolivian psycho-spiritual Oscar Icazo from the 1950s and the Chilean psychiatrist Claudio Naranjo from the 1970s. Okay. So this is something that is big in business management and spirituality contexts. And I'm going to like this. I'm going to be going to some a conference that, among other things, was we were asked to take an Enneagram test just for fun. I guess there are nine different categories: the perfectionist, the helper, the achiever, the individualist, the investigator, the loyalist, the enthusiast, the challenger, and the peacemaker.
Mm.
So we're about to find out which of those nine I am. Do you have any guesses? Which do you think you are?
There's a whole chart,
right,
on the website and on Wikipedia. It's amazing. I think you are the achiever slash performer. The achiever performer. That's what it is. I don't know. The one that I'm looking at has like a first thing, a first word that you are, and then another thing. Achiever performer, ego fixation. What does this mean? Vanity, I guess, is the bad thing that you could be fixated on. Vanity, holy idea is hope and law. Okay, I think this is what you are. Basic fear, worthlessness. Do you think that's your?
Oh, well, for sure.
Yeah, okay.
Now, my basic fear is that this thing is not recording. But I don't know if that's not on this list. Okay. Wow, okay. I just opened this up. So I am type 5.
Oh, okay.
The investigator.
Hmm.
So I guess they give you a score. So they give you like a score. My highest score was in the investigator category. Mm-hmm. And second was the achiever. So okay. I got a 24 in investigator and a 22 in achiever.
That was close. That was close. And they're kind of similar, actually, now that I'm reading. Your holy idea, according to this. What does that mean?
H-O-L-Y?
Yeah. Holy
my
idea.
Holy idea.
That's what I'm looking at a chart.
Okay,
and
I
it's saying
that is my core value
is transparency and omniscience. What
omniscience? Yes, no, that's what? You. Are you
no,
kidding?
But, yeah,
you know all. You
well,
know
no,
all.
But I don't feel like it's and transparency. I guess they go together. Your trap is that you can be trapped as an observer. I guess I don't know what this means.
Investigator observer are actually they go together. So that's what I would be. Right.
Your basic desire is mastery and understanding. Is that true, do you think?
I guess so. My basic fear is helplessness, incapability, and incompetence. Okay. My temptation is replacing direct experience with concepts. That's true. I'd say that's true. My vice, this is according to Wikipedia, by the way. My vice or passion is avarice. And my virtue is detachment. Uh-huh. See, people have said that my vice is detachment. So I like this. I like this reframing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah. So I came in second for achiever. I came in third for individualist. I came in fourth for loyalist. So right in the middle there. My loyalty to you is just totally mid. Reformer, I got a total of 17 points. Peacemaker, I got a total of 15 points. Enthusiast, just 14. The challenger, only 11 points. That's second to last. And you know what I scored the least amount of points in by a lot? The helper.
Megan.
I'm not helping. So sorry, Mr. Rogers.
The helper.
Aww. He said, look for the helpers.
Yeah, that's true.
This is not looking for me. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Thank you, Enneagram. So I don't know. Does this mean I need to change any of my behaviors?
Nonsense. I don't know.
What are the key learnings from this?
You're not going to help me. Well, what am I learning? I'm learning a lot.
Right.
This is for work. So they're going to analyze this about you and be like, okay, you're not going to, she's not going to be very helpful. She shouldn't be put on teams.
Like, she's not going to be helpful at this conference. So like, yeah, like basically I am one of those people that at the end of the event, you know, I'm like, I end up getting into a conversation while everybody is cleaning up. You know, like they're cleaning up the plates and they're, you know, moving the food. And then I'm talking with somebody. And then by the time I get finished talking, I would have helped, but everybody already cleaned everything up.
I'm a cleaner. I like cleaning.
You are?
Yeah. I clean like during parties. Like I'll be throwing a party and it's in the middle of a party and I'm like drunk and cleaning.
You're one of those people.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe I would be a helper. Do you think? No.
Well, you should take it.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what any of this means. I think it's there's just like, these things. Like I feel like I've taken so many different personality assessments, like the MTBI thing, MBTI, MTBI.
What's that?
You know what I'm talking about.
Is that when they say that you're like
MBTI? Yeah. MBTI. It's the Myers-Briggs. Types. Mm-hmm. That's the one that I'm most familiar with. And I don't know how bunk it is. It seems like it's like the self-report thing. Like, yeah, I think I'm super independent, you know, but
right.
I think it would be more accurate if like people who knew you really well took the test for you,
right.
Like
yes,
answering
exactly.
What describes Megan, what describes Sarah. And then you took it. And then there was like a kind of a.
Oh, yeah.
We should take it
for each other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. We can do that.
Or have the listeners take it.
I think it would have been close though, what I would have answered, because just looking at the chart, I, you know, the second one that the second to highest one was the one that I would have marked you as. I doubt it'd be too different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yes. So I'm going as not just so nobody gets the wrong idea. My friend, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. My friend, Michael, who is a listener, is an executive coach, and he's doing a sort of retreat, and he invited me to come. And this was one of our many prep items. So thank you, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, I think the general idea is solid, which is just like know yourself and know your strengths and weaknesses, and create a kind of environment that, you know, enhances what's good about you and makes up for what isn't.
Yeah.
You know, I think that makes sense.
I try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a number of items to discuss. It's very, very happy items, both of them. We're going to talk about Christy Noem, AKA Doggate. And then we're going to talk about Harvey Weinstein. So I don't know which is sunnier. I guess the news is that Christy Noem is a person and she is the governor of South Dakota. That was the big news as far as I could see.
Yeah. I mean, we're just, we're not like political horse race people. So it might be that there are people who knew who she was before.
Well, she's thought to be one of Trump's high up on the list of Trump's VP picks. Okay. I think that's why she's culturally relevant. And she has a book coming out next month called Not My First Rodeo.
Okay. I have experience is the whole point of that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems youngish. She seems young.
She's 51, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's good. My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland.
I'm getting Sarah Palin vibes.
Yeah, for sure.
The Guardian broke the news because they got an advanced copy of her book, which we were not able to get.
No,
sadly.
I mean, these books are embargoed. I would love to get copies. You would read this?
Yeah. I mean, just to see. I just want to hear it from her own lips, you know. But The Guardian wrote it.
You think she wrote this herself? Okay.
No, but it's
from
like
her ghostwriter's own lips.
Right. It's a narrative she approves of. So it gives you a good insight on like, what does this person think is flattering, really? You know, like what it tells you something about them in like kind of a meta way as well. The Guardian published, broke the news. I guess they looked over the book and then they found this terrible anecdote that she shared about her life. And this was in order to prove, I guess, that she can, you know, do the hard thing. She'll do the ugly thing, the hard thing, but the necessary thing, and she has what it takes to do it. So she talks about her dog, Cricket. And she writes, Cricket was a wire hair pointer. What is that? I don't know what that means.
It's a hunting dog.
Okay. That, okay. About 14 months old, adding that the dog, a female, had an aggressive personality and needed to be trained to be used for hunting pheasant.
Yeah, the pheasant hunting dog. So they would go, so you shoot the pheasant and the pheasant falls into the field and the dog goes and retrieves it.
Mm-hmm.
The dog does not go out and physically attack the pheasant and hunt for you.
Okay,
it's assisting you in your hunting.
Isn't this what retrievers used to do?
Yeah, this is what. Yeah, this,
or hunting do they dogs, still do it?
Hunting dogs are, I believe, to either help you find the. I think they are to go out and get the thing that you killed and drag it back.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so this is from the Guardian piece. What unfolds over the next few pages shows how that effort went very wrong indeed. This is the effort to train this dog. And remarkably, how Cricket was not the only domestic animal Noam chose to kill one day in hunting season. okay, so they keep... They say a little more about her books, about her book and what she shares. So what she does one day, she takes Cricket on a pheasant hunt with older dogs, hoping to calm the young dog and to teach her how to behave. But Cricket ruins the hunt and goes, quote, out of her mind with excitement, chasing all those birds and having the time of her life. Noam describes calling Cricket, then using an electronic collar to attempt to bring her under control. Nothing worked. Then on the way home after the hunt, as Noam stopped to talk to a local family, Cricket escaped Gnome's truck and attacked the family's chickens, quote, grabbing one chicken at a time, crunching it to death with one bite, then dropping it to attack another. That's a horrifying that's a horrifying scene.
Cricket
what?
Just needs ADHD medication. That's all.
Crunching you know, to death? Like just
Cricket,
like right at the head or
Cricket
right at the neck
needed
something?
A timeout, needed to see a therapist. Needed some medication, maybe an IEP eventually. Just needed some special services. But okay, fine. They're standing around. She's talking with her neighbor. I hate when this happens, when I'm talking with my neighbor. I believe me, it's really embarrassing.
Noam finally grabbed Cricket, she says, the dog, quote, whipped around to bite me, end quote. Then as the chicken's owner wept, because this is a whole Greek drama, Noam repeatedly apologized, wrote the Shock family a check for the price they asked, and helped them dispose of the carcasses, littering the scene of the crime. Through it all, Noam says, Cricket was the picture of pure joy.
So happy with herself. I'm sure.
This is a
Cricket was delighted with her actions.
Dog.
Yes.
I hated that dog, Gnome writes, adding that Cricket had proved herself untrainable and dangerous to anyone she came in contact with and less than worthless as a hunting dog. At that moment, Gnome said, I realized I had to put her down. And so she, you know, gets her gun and leads the dog to a gravel pit and then does it. And then after it was over, realizes that that's not the only, you know, dirty deed that needs to be done by somebody strong, but you know, tough. Mm-hmm. As the Guardian puts it, incredibly, Gnome's tale of slaughter is not finished. Her family also owned a male goat that was nasty and mean because it had not been castrated. Furthermore, the goat smelled disgusting, musky, rancid, and loved to chase Gnome's children, knocking them down and ruining their clothes. So she decides to kill the goat the same way she killed the dog.
Okay.
So
this, it was causing a huge stir. People are very, very upset about this and angry. This is a huge story. It's all over the place. Everyone on Twitter was posting photos of their own dog as a sort of show of solidarity. I know. I also posted a photo of Hugo, who I've never shot, but he's on the verge of shooting me pretty much all the time. Mm. Look, I hate this story. I don't think this is the way to deal with this kind of situation. However, a lot of stuff happens on farms that people not on farms with pets don't want to think about. I've actually lived on a farm, believe it or not. And yeah, stuff happened to animals that I really don't want to talk about and that were, you know, it was quite upsetting. However, frankly, it was the most humane thing to do. Tell me what is less humane. Shooting your dog on the spot in a moment of joy after it has had the time of its life, killing a bunch of chickens and immediately causing no suffering to the dog whatsoever, or letting your dog suffer well into old age when it is sick, when it maybe cannot walk, because you can't be grown up and put it down. There is absolutely no reason to keep an animal alive when it is suffering. It's the epitome of human selfishness. And I see it all the time. And I think people really need to stop and think about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I don't have any dogs and I can't, you know, speak to, you know, the love a woman has for her dog, but I, you know, okay. So pushing back a little bit on what you just said, people might say, well, Cricket was not suffering, you know, like Cricket was happy. Cricket was having the time of her life. Mm-hmm. So putting her down was unnecessary. Maybe just take her away from like that specific activity or put her away from animals, I guess, like other animals. Rehome her, maybe.
Yeah. Look, I don't know. I'm not saying, like I said, I'm not saying this was exactly the right thing to do in this situation. However, it's entirely possible that rehoming Cricket would have meant Cricket ends up in a shelter where she's in a tiny cell or cage and suffering, only to get adopted by somebody who also cannot handle her, who maybe puts her on a chain, mm-hmm. who gives her a terrible life. And this just is a cycle that goes, you know, just repeats itself over and over again. Mm-hmm. And she would have been better off having her, you know, last moment of glory when she was 14 months old, living on a farm with the governor of South Dakota. I don't know. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But let's really think about this. So many of these animals live terrible lives. Mm-hmm. If you're going to like have your dog live tied up to a fence or, you know, tied up to a pole, tied up on a chain because you can't be bothered to fence in your yard, that's cruelty to me, in my opinion. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear your belly aching about what somebody decided to do on a farm. And in the meantime, you're like living in a tiny apartment with a border collie mm-hmm. that's bouncing off the walls. I don't want to hear about it.
I lived with many dogs back before, like, I had my own place to live. And twice I was living in, like, kind of a smallish space. Once it was an apartment. The other time it was, like, kind of a townhouse. And I had roommates with dogs, with, like, big dogs. They were both labs, like, big, big labs. And in the first case, like, we were in an apartment where you were not allowed to have big dogs. And the dog would bark a lot, like, at night. And it was very loud. And the neighbors would complain. And she was going to get in trouble. So she would lock her dog in, like, the bathroom all night. And that dog was just... It was just in this tiny, tiny space for most of its day.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't understand how that I just thought it was such a cruel thing to do to a dog. And she was in kind of a difficult situation, I think, is because, like, her mom had some issues that she had to take in the dog for some reason. Regardless, I thought it was just awful. Yeah. The whole thing was awful. And then I had another roommate who broke up with her boyfriend and got custody of their dog or something. And even though the boyfriend had, like, a yard, a house, she chose to keep the dog. And she would lock the dog up in our garage for most of the day. She would go to work and just put the dog in the garage because the dog was not potty trained or trained at all, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the dog would just, like, go to the bathroom everywhere. And that was her life. It was, like, caged in. And that dog was afraid. Like, whenever I would let her into, you know, our house, like, when I'd be home and I'd be like, oh, this poor dog, you know, she would be frightened, you know, and she would go everywhere, like, go to the bathroom everywhere. Like, I don't know, maybe what was going on with her psychologically.
It's so sad. It's terrible.
I contemplated calling somebody or saying something because I felt like this was abuse, what she was doing. But it doesn't seem like it occurred to her that it was abuse. I just feel like
I love my dog. Well, that's like people say, but I love my kids. And then they, abuse them.
It was horrible. This poor dog. I felt so bad for her. I feel like I know multiple, like, these were the people where I lived with said dog and saw it, saw the treatment. But I know of many more cases like that with, young friends of mine in college or immediately after college adopting a dog as kind of a, hey, why not? Like, I got the dog, she's such a cutie. And taking the dog to a little apartment where the dog is living a miserable life forever.
You know, I mean, this is, you know, if emotions govern your life and people have no gratification delay and they just, you know, it's very easy to fall in love with a puppy and want to take it home. It's the oldest story in the world, right? Yeah, That's why dogs end up in shelters.
Yeah.
I mean, look, to be clear, I think Cricket probably a better thing to do would have been to try a little bit harder to find somebody who could train Cricket. I don't think, you know, South Dakota is probably not full of animal trainers who are trying to get TV deals on the Animal Planet channel the way we have in Los Angeles. And like, not every dog trainer I know in New York or LA is like trying to get a deal as a celebrity dog trainer or influencer. So I'm not saying it's the same culture. Please don't take this out of context and tell everybody that I'm saying that Kristi Noem did the right thing. I'm just saying, let's look at the big picture here. People are very emotionally irrational about animals. And I find it especially rich that PETA, of all places, People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, is issuing statements decrying this action that Kristi Noem did. Because PETA is euthanizes more dogs than any other, more animals than any other quote unquote rescue organization there is. Their shelters are like, you know, massive kill shelters. And actually they do so they have an ethical argument about that. I mean, Ingrid Newkirk, who I don't know if she was the founder of PETA, but she's sort of the most famous leaders associated with it, was like known for taking dogs out of abusive situations, sort of, you know, rescuing them and quote unquote rescuing them and then having them euthanized. Now, they could make an argument that that is actually a more humane thing to do. It's similar to the argument that I'm making. And obviously, everything's on a case-by-case basis. But if you've got a dog that is, you know, has been traumatized, that is damaged, that is pretty clearly not going to be able to be rehabilitated. And if that dog is either going to live its life tied to a pole on a very short leash or be euthanized, tell me which is more humane.
Have you ever seen a dog or any animal be killed?
My own. Euthanized my own dogs. Mm. I mean, my dog Phoebe, I had a St. Bernard who was a rescue, and she had been, she was probably like a pit St. Bernard mix, but she was mostly looked like a big St. Bernard. She had horrible orthopedic problems because she had probably been in a puppy mill. And I don't know how old she was. She was probably 6 years old, and she was she was not very sweet. She was sweet with me, but she had a messed up temperament and was not reliable with other dogs. And she would get aggressive with other dogs, and she was scary. So she was like a lot to manage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it got to the point where she couldn't walk anymore. She had horrible orthopedic problems because of her terrible breeding, and she had no other health problems. And I had to make a choice to, you know, either have her, every time I took her out, I could have had a sling to prop her up so she could walk, which was actually what the vet was recommending, or I could put her down. And I put her down. And, you know, it was interesting because I took her to the vet, and it was a great vet. This was in New York. And they were kind of giving me these options, like, this is what you can do. And I had been treating her for quite a while to help her. She was on steroids. She had actually gotten a lot better. Her walking was better. Like, she had a pretty decent quality of life. I had done everything I could to help her. And then just everything stopped working. She was not going to get any better. And the vet was like, well, you can do this, this, and this. You can have a sling every time you take her out. And I was like, well, are those the only choices? And I said, and this is what you have to say to these vets. I said, what would you do if it was your dog? And this vet, he was actually a neurologist. Mm-hmm. Phoebe was going to a veterinary neurologist because part of her problem was actually neuroskeletal.
Okay.
And the vet started, he was a pretty young guy. He started crying. He choked up. And he said, well, you know, you got to consider her quality of life. Mm-hmm. And so I put her down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's so funny. Even me, after my whole rant, I had neighbors, you know, they said, oh, my gosh, you put Phoebe down. And a few of them said, yeah, you did the right thing. It was time. She was in pain. And nobody could tell you. It's like, you can't tell your neighbor that they should put their dog down. Mm-hmm. You just can't say that kind of thing. And nobody can see it. It's very hard to see your own situation. You can look at other people's. So no, it's hard. And before people yell at me for having a big dog in the city, I would never have like a lab or a border collie in a small apartment. I have had Newfoundland. Hugo's in Newfoundland. I did have him in a New York apartment, and I had Phoebe St. Bernard in a New York apartment. And those dogs actually do fine in apartments. Mm. It doesn't have to do with the size. It has to do with the temperament of the dog. And I always worked from home. I would never like leave a dog alone for long periods of time. Yeah. No, I always work from home. I take them out all the time. They had a good life. Mm-hmm. So anyway, my prediction is that actually the backlash to the backlash for Kristi Noem is going to be such, this is going to help her.
This is going to help her
in the long run. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause this I think a lot of people will read that story and they'll be like, that she's not a villain for doing this.
No. And they're gonna be like these libtards with their dogs, all these childless pet owning, cucks.
Yeah.
Are exactly, you know, the enemy here. So, well done.
Oh, yeah. It's just virtue well signaling done, thing. It's irritating. It's, yeah. You know, it doesn't feel, I watched a segment. I don't know. It was on MSNBC or something about the story, and they were reading from the same Guardian article, and they were just like,
yeah.
And I was just like, I don't know what we're reacting to here. This is just she's describing a life that one, you don't live, right? And the dog just like killed a bunch of animals. It wasn't as if like it hadn't shown that.
Yeah.
It could
what if
be
it was
going
to kill a kid?
What if it was like a toddler next? Yeah.
Right. I mean, what? So, and also like, would it have been better if she took it, if she had like the nice vet come out and euthanize it with a nice tranquilizer? Yeah, and then an injection. that's what we do in the big city.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the difference? If you're a good shot and you can get it one time.
Yeah.
I honestly don't see the difference.
No. And it's just irresponsible, I think, to just be like, but you could have done this and you could have done that. I mean, in the case, if this kid dog went back into a shelter, was adopted by a family, you know, with a toddler, and then the toddler gets messed up because of this dog at some point. We don't know what you could be doing.
We don't know. And it's entirely possible she was overreacting. It's entirely possible that the dog would have been rescued by somebody who knew what they were doing. I'm sure the dog could have been the star of some show on the cable animal channels, but that's not what happened. And people need to realize that their hysteria is only fueling the other side yet again. So anyway, that is my counterintuitive take.
When did you live on a farm?
I lived on a farm in Nebraska. So I was so, yeah, when I wrote a whole book about this. Yeah, when I was 30, I moved from New York to Nebraska.
You gotta read all your books. No reason. You're just writing so many books.
You'd hate
books.
Them.
You have so many books, and it's like, how am I gonna do this? Is that the whole backlog?
There's only six.
Of like Megan not, writings not to too go many. Through.
Not too many. Yeah, no, I did. I was like, I was not a working farm, but I lived out in a little house on 12 acres, and
how long
was I lived there for a couple of years, and I did. We had kind of a crazy boyfriend, and we had a lot of animals, and it wasn't so pretty sometimes.
Mm. I've always dreamed of like going into the woods somewhere, like some rural thing.
You've always dreamed of going into the woods?
Yeah, like Unabomber style.
Wandering into the woods by yourself. Yeah.
But I like the idea of it a lot, but I think it is just a fantasy. I don't know how I would.
It was definitely a fantasy. Yeah. It was a kind of a silly, Little House on the Prairie fantasy of mine.
I'm more of an adventure survivalist fantasy, but it is nevertheless like a Walden fantasy. That's my, that's what mine is like. I doubt I would actually enjoy the situation, but maybe I would. I don't know. I do like being alone, like, and I do like being in very, very kind of outdoorsy, no sign of human like exploration or inhabitants kind of places. I like that a lot. I like being in, I feel calmer. I feel like my anxiety goes away when I'm in places like that. You know?
Well, there's always hope. Just the whole fan live on Walden Pond.
Damn it. Yeah, I know. This is the problem with having a family, is you can never, like, that's not real anymore.
Right.
That's
Are
not
you
something
kidding?
That can ever happen.
Well, you could be a trad wife and just take everybody off the grid. And
I don't, but I would need a I would need a husband to agree to that. We need a trad husband, and he's never going to leave his computers. So.
Mm-hmm.
That is.
Okay. Yeah. Well, speaking of trad husbands, we're going to talk about Harvey Weinstein. How much do you know about this case before we get into the news here? What do you know about Harvey Weinstein? I'm just curious.
I mean, other than what everybody knows, I know what everybody knows, and that's it. But about the actual trial and the case, I don't think I paid too much attention at the time. I was paying attention to the Me Too scandal. And the movement that it spawned, but not in particular, like the details of that court case. But it turns out I should have been, because it was thrown out, right?
Like, yeah. So there were two cases, one in California and one in New York, rape and sexual assault cases against Harvey Weinstein, Hollywood executive. Probably, you know, one of the most successful Hollywood producers in Hollywood history. I mean, he's responsible for movies like Shakespeare in Love and Cinema Paradiso, and was really sort of like the godfather of the independent film movement. He founded Miramax with his brother Bob Weinstein. So he was a notorious bully, just really, really. Very powerful, and everybody sucked up to him, but he was very scary, mercurial, very abusive to his staff and others. And, you know, it would get into situations with actresses where it became very transactional. So he would be making clear that if they did him certain sexual favors, he would repay the favors by potentially casting them in a movie. And in the wake of the Me Too era, sort of the chickens came home to roost. He was a guy who was pretty disliked by a lot of people and also really powerful. And a handful of actresses came forward to say that he had either raped them in a hotel room kind of thing or assaulted him. But what happened in the New York case was that even though there were two, in the end, there were two main accusers. I mean, hundreds of women, I think, had been interviewed about this and had had dealings with him. But really, the only two that were thought to have any kind of case that would hold up in court were these two women. Jessica Mann was the name of one, and Miriam Haley, yes, was the other one. But what happened was there were a whole bunch of other women that were allowed to come in as, I don't know what you would call them. They're like kind of character witnesses.
Bad
sort of thing.
Act witnesses, according to an
article. Right. Okay.
I read about it.
Yeah. And this was a little bit unorthodox, but not unprecedented. So a whole bunch of other women sort of just testified and were talking about how he had been terrible to them at various times. Annabella Sciorra was one of them, was the really the only one who was well known. She's a pretty well known actress. She was in The Sopranos most recently, but has been in a lot of movies in the 90s. And the thing is, it was very hit and miss. Like, they would talk about how he had done something in a hotel room, but then they also in some cases would like go on to date him. And I think even Jessica Mann, who was one of the main accusers, like, she would talk about how he did something, he raped her allegedly, but then she would like make sure to always call him the next day. She wanted to introduce him to her mother. I think that was the one, if I'm conflating this with Haley, Miriam Haley. Excuse me. I shouldn't get too detailed, actually, because I'm inevitably going to get some of this wrong. But the upshot is that this was just a big mishmash of testimony and kind of foggy memories and inconsistencies. And because of the climate of the Me Too movement and because of the leanings of the judges and other people involved in the legal system, he went to prison for 25 years. He's been serving time in New York State, and they found that there had not been enough evidence. So they overturned the rape conviction, and he's in the hospital now being evaluated. I think he is still, you know, he was also convicted in California, so I'm not sure what would happen if he went back to California. I'm not entirely sure on the details. But anyway, I think this is an example of how even those of us who think that we're like super critical thinkers about this kind of thing are prone to not following stories closely and just assuming that what we read is true. It turns out the gulf between what was reported in the media and what actually went on in the courtroom was huge.
Mm-hmm. That makes me very nervous. I mean, I know you don't agree with me fully here, but I've, these sorts of experiences where I feel kind of misled way after the fact, you know, and in a way that, you know, my understanding of the situation at the time did something to me, you know, like it changed the way that I proceeded. It affected my thinking about the reality of our world and what I have to be watching out for and what's true and what isn't true. And, you know, And then years later, you find out that it isn't as solid as it was presented. It makes me nervous. And then the next time there's this huge wave of, you know, social justice, you know, indignation or whatever, I start to get more wary than, you know, I feel like I slip in more easily into a passive role when things like this happen. I kind of feel that way about a lot of the war talk, you know,
mm-hmm.
like this, all over my feed. It's constantly there's genocide, and just people are just losing it, you know, losing it. And I just feel like I don't know what's true. You know, yeah. I don't know what's true. And I don't trust the people who are supposed to be filtering information out for us. Some of them are probably right and doing things in the right way, but some of them are not. And I can't tell who's who. So I think it's just better to take on, you know, kind of a passive role and wait it out until, you know, 3 years later, 5 years later, we can cool down and take a more measured approach. It's, I don't like feeling this way, though. You know, it just makes me feel very helpless. No, I don't either.
It makes me feel crazy, and it makes me feel cynical.
Helpless, I think, because it's like, I don't know. I like knowing what's going on in my world, and I like feeling like I know what's going on in my world, I should say, because maybe I've never really known. But I like being able to think that I can trust the information coming my way, that it is more signal than noise. And I just don't feel that way about so many things. And so there's bound to be a time where I, you know, sit back and take this position of we don't know yet, when clearly something is happening, you know, like it's the girl who cried wolf kind of a thing, or boy who cried. Did it? Was it a boy?
It's a boy. I don't know why you have to be so gender essential. I'm sorry. Could have been a girl. Girls are just as capable of crying wolf.
Definitely.
Boys, yes. If not more so.
But, you know, it's that kind of thing. Like sometimes there will be a true, you know, injustice that plays out right in front of our eyes. And I won't know whether to believe my eyes, you know, because my eyes, quote unquote, are these.
No, I know.
Journalist accounts that I just can't trust.
The thing is, though, that even back in 2020, people were sounding the alarm about this. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember following the story and being like, wait, why? Why are all these women testifying? And why are they saying things that have nothing to do with this? Yeah. It seemed very strange. So, and there was even some press coverage. Remarkably, there's a piece in The Nation by Joanne Wypajewski. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. In The Nation, of all places, okay? This is from February 2020, Why Harvey Weinstein Might Walk. And so she was reporting on this case for The Nation. And I'm just going to read a little bit from her piece, because she talks about being with a group of reporters, you know, in the courtroom every day. This is a media circus. People are packed in there every day. So Joanne writes, a group of us had been talking after listening to direct and cross-examination of Jessica Mann, whose claims were central to the prosecution's case. Okay, she says, these are four New York strangers, three women, one man of different age and class. Okay, this is from 2020. One Black, one Latinx, two white, an independent filmmaker, an activist, a recent college graduate, and me. So she's talking about people who are just sort of watching this. I don't think they're all reporters. She said, unintentionally, we were thinking like jurors charged to decide if the state was meeting its burden of proof. We had doubts. Our conversation echoed those I'd had before and those I'd have in the coming days with others on the public line, backed against a wall, waiting for scarce seats in a large courtroom already filled with guests and more than 100 credentialed reporters. Those reporters, so she's talking about most of the reporters covering this, betrayed no curiosity about the public observer's assessment of events, at least not that I witnessed across many days I attended. On the elevators and in the restroom, their banter stopped abruptly when they noticed us. So I'm assuming she's talking about reporters from the New York Times, NPR, all the usuals. Okay. For the most part, their dispatches parroted the prosecution's narrative. The public line was scrappy and searching. So, you know, she's a young woman who days earlier had argued away the contradictions in a prosecution witness testimony had decided it is a very weak case. News accounts I'd seen only emphasized the strength of the case. Hmm. All right. So this is a remarkable piece. The fact that it's published in The Nation mm-hmm. is pretty amazing. Yeah. This writer, I'd actually love to have her on the show. She's the author of a book called What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, that came out in June 2020.
Like an interesting book, actually.
Amazing. Yeah. I didn't hear about it. I did not read about that book in the New York Times. Maybe I missed it. But yeah, I just, it's amazing that this kind of thing is allowed to happen. And I mean, obviously Harvey Weinstein is just a proxy for so many things that we hate about men, hate mm-hmm. about human beings. I mean, one of the things about this trial was like everything that was revealed about his genitalia. I mean, do you know about this aspect?
No.
Like, you know, a lot of the witnesses that they were asked to describe the sexual, you know, the nature of the assaults. I mean, in one of the assaults actually involved him performing oral sex on the woman, like forcing himself on her that way. Mm-hmm. And then it came up that he was not exactly sexually functional. And then they talked about him being deformed, about him being smelly and sweaty. I mean, he was absolutely just made into this grotesque monster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was digging around a little bit about this. It turns out that he had this this terrible condition called Fournier gangrene, which is like a bacterial infection that you get in your, you know, crotch, basically. And this, I think this was in like 1999 or in the 90s, sometime. And they like took his, this sounds made up, but this is what's been reported. They took his testicles and like removed them and then sewed them on to his inner thighs. It's just bizarre.
What?
Yeah.
What?
And this was right. And this was being discussed in the courtroom He was being mocked. Yeah. I mean, this is absolutely catastrophically humiliating, mm-hmm. which is really all anybody I think wanted for Harvey Weinstein. I think they wanted him to be humiliated and just forced to be bullied by the people he had bullied. I mean, this is a guy who threw sandwiches at his assistants, threw phones would go into rages. His own brother, with whom he had formed Miramax, severed ties with him. The guy's really messed up.
There was in the piece in The Nation from 2020, there was a really interesting segment about the discussion of his body that I thought was pretty, pretty interesting. So I'm just gonna like read directly from it. It was what you said, that he was described as already a metaphorical monster. He was made a monster at trial, physically deformed, abnormal, intersex, disgusting, scarred, grunting, with bumpy skin, lumpy semen or no semen, fat, hairy, stinking of shit, sorry, poop, a beast, unmanned, subhuman, possibly autistic, but also a genius. Never has body shaming and the beauty trap, the normal trap, quote unquote, been so wielded as a weapon of presumed progressive justice. As my fellow observer suggested, the shaming of Weinstein inevitably required that his accusers be ashamed too. Jessica Mann said, honestly, I felt compassion for him and also spoke about the quote unquote negotiation. I thought we were creating a fantasy as if we were having normal sex. Anyway, I think she goes on to say, in this setting, though, she could not possibly admit that she had ever had any attraction or any pleasure across the years that she was intimately involved with him. This raised questions on the public line, perhaps among the jury, if he's really so damaged and insecure about impotence, etc. Might he have needed to believe the lies women told of love? What if they didn't act like victims, but like volunteers? So the piece was really interesting and raises a lot of, quite thorny questions that I don't think.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, if he's described this way, you can't, maybe you reframe how you approached the sexual encounter, rape, assault, whatever, with him. I do have a question for you. Do you think that imagine if there had not been like retaliation, right? So he was accused of also retaliating against women who would like spur his advances. Yeah. Imagine if that hadn't been the case. If he would just be like, hey, if you participate in such and such act with me, you can have like a little career boost. Or it's like kind of understood that that's what would happen. But there wouldn't be a downside to saying no necessarily. If that was what had actually happened, or if that was happening today, do you think that that's a problem necessarily?
That would have changed the game. Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Well, it makes me think of the Louis C.K. stuff, right? Because a lot of the real problem that the women had, so the idea was that he was always asking these women if he could masturbate in front of them. And sometimes they said yes, and sometimes they said no. And the real grievance wasn't that he had done that, but then he allegedly retaliated against those who said no, or that his manager, so a couple of them had said no, including one that was just like on the phone or something, right, who felt like she couldn't hang up the phone. And I guess the story was that his manager then approached them and said, hey, if you tell anybody about this, there are going to be repercussions for your career in comedy, and tried to shut them up that way. I think if that had not happened, this story would be very different. Right. Not that it excuses what he did. That's bizarre. I mean, the parallels between, I mean, I am a fan of Louis C.K. and I'm not a fan of Harvey Weinstein, although I guess I'm a fan of many of Harvey Weinstein's movies, so whatever. But I mean, just the way that men can get off on humiliation, it is a fetish.
Both theirs and others. Everybody.
Yes. And their own. I mean, it's funny because, you know, Harvey Weinstein is the one that like jerked off in a potted plant, apparently. But often that story gets attributed to Louis C.K.
Yeah, I thought
Louis
it was Louis C.K. Shoot. I'm one of those people.
Right.
No,
don't go stealing my plant thunder. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Well, I want to read a little bit more from this Nation piece, actually, because this is so Jessica Mann. And again, these are not successful actresses. These are women who have come to Hollywood. I think Jessica Mann's case, she was from a small town. Is she the one that was from a dairy farm? Again, I don't mean to be conflating Miriam Haley and Jessica Mann, but in any case. Okay, so Jessica Mann spent the longest time on the stand. She testified that she had lied to the defendant, to Weinstein, to her friends, to her boyfriend, to her mother, to her psychic, to her life coach over the years when, in emails or recorded phone calls, she said that Weinstein, quote, validated her, understands her, was, quote, nothing but good to her, made her feel so fabulous and beautiful. When she said she loved him and had set, quote, boundaries in the relationship. So apparently she said all that stuff to people. There was evidence saying she had said that stuff, but now she was saying on the stand that those were all lies. She said that a friend waited in the sitting room of the hotel suite while she was being bullied and orally raped by Weinstein, that she had slept on the floor of that friend's closet when she chose to stay an extra night in New York after the alleged vaginal rape so that she could go to a screening and celebrate Weinstein's birthday the next day. The friend, now former friend, was not called by the prosecution. So testifying under subpoena for the defense, the friend contradicted Mann in large and small ways and was one of the trial's most credible witnesses. And the, you know, this Nation reporter says, other than friends of the prosecutors or members of the DA's office, no one I talked with felt confident that they could tell when Mann was telling the truth and when she wasn't. So it's like, this is just a really big mess. And I have to say, I had no idea what a big mess it was. I knew it was a little bit of a mess.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where I was kind of like, I don't know.
I didn't want to look too much into it. There are times where it's like, you know, you can only have the, you know, heterodox take on like, right. On so many topics things. You know, right.
Otherwise you lose credibility. I know, right? You gotta decide.
I didn't do this deliberately, but I think there's a part of like self-serving kind of self, not serving, but protective almost instinct to, you know, I don't want to look into this because I don't want to be red pilled or whatever on yet.
I don't want to be that person.
I don't want to be that person on this one. Again. Right. No, I can't do it. Not all the time. Sometimes I just want to agree with what, you know, all the correct people have to say, mm-hmm. and be an empathetic ear to all these very sad women. So it's
mm-hmm. And Harvey Weinstein's a good one. I mean, that he's
terrible.
He is a monster.
Right.
He's a really easy one to do
hate.
This to.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the fog of Me Too, there were a lot of people who certain people wanted to see go down.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the evidence for it. They don't have evidence, credible evidence, useful evidence for a lot of these cases. But if you're going to pick one person to scapegoat, this would be the one. I was Matt Lauer, apparently. I feel like I heard this recently. I have to double check this. You know, the whole. So what when you think of the Matt Lauer thing, what's the thing that you think of?
Was he the one with the button in the.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So Matt Lauer would like have women in his office and he would like hit a button and like suddenly all the like the shades would go down and the doors would lock.
It's like a villain. And they're just like looking around like, okay, what's happening?
And yeah, apparently that is not true.
What? No, Megan.
Yeah.
All these major.
I'm looking this up right now. I could be wrong. Let's see. Well, despite numerous erroneous reports in the past, there was not a button in my office that could lock the door from the inside. There was no such mechanism. It didn't exist. NBC confirmed this publicly following my termination. Okay. So that's what Matt said. However, according to Business Insider, playing with semantics and his denial of it. All right. I don't know.
Okay.
I would,
I don't know. I don't know what to believe anymore.
I don't know either. I mean, I think it would be cool. It's like being in your car, I guess. Like you hit a button and all the doors lock. It would be cool to have that for your office.
Why do you need it in your office? I mean, that's a kind of strange place to lock people inside with you.
Well,
right?
If you had your, say you brought your dog to work with you.
Uh-huh.
And you wanted to keep it in your small office during the day.
Exactly.
And the dog was very rambunctious and was going to like potentially break down the door. You would want to have a lock and be able to lock your dog inside your office.
Yeah.
While you went to a meeting.
Yeah.
In the conference room.
And then you come back and shoot it in the head.
That scenario, that would be useful.
Yeah.
Well, I would recommend to people Sarah Heppala and Nancy Rommelman on the Smoke 'Em If You Got 'Em podcast had an interview with a couple of podcasters who made a podcast about the many, many part podcast about the Harvey Weinstein trial called Harvey Weinstein Unfiltered. I had no idea this podcast existed. It is many, many parts. They had it's a husband and wife podcasting team. They had them on and they talked about this at length. So I suggest people check that out. But we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. I am sad to see the case reopen in this way.
Well, but I mean, if that's.
But at least, it's better if it's justice. If it's now due process, we're getting closer to it. Yeah,
yeah.
Sure. It's good that it's happening. But just sad that about what it reveals. About how we know things and the nature of our news media and how they respond to like movements
it's just one of these things where emotions ruled the day, and also the emotions of women, and you know, the idea that nobody would question this, that the judges that were appointed and that the judges that were on the case and nobody was found, you know, apparently even when they were, you know, there were jury members, more than a few, certainly more than one, who when asked if they felt they could be objective about the case, said they could not, and they remained on the jury.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just this idea that if we're talking about something like women's safety or women's trauma or what women believe to be true, like all bets are off.
I've always it's sad, and I don't think, I mean, it's based on a good instinct to protect women. You know, I think it's an instinct that women and men both have. Everybody has. When you see a weeping woman, you know, we feel a certain way about her. We want to protect her. We want to, you know, fix whatever it is that happened. But of course, that leaves us prone to being manipulated. Maybe not even like in a way that I don't think the person who is doing the manipulation necessarily understands that that's what they're doing. But it's instinctual sometimes. And, you know, it happens. And it causes miscarriages of justice. You know, I thought a lot about, you know, when I was more directly involved in activism, how like emotion and sort of portraying an emotion in a believable way affected my activism and my ability to be an effective activist. And it's not something I know how to fake. I'm not a good actress unless maybe I could be, I guess, but in my mind, that's a lie.
Not too late. But it's not. Look, Harvey Weinstein's going to be out again. What? So all you have to do is like let him orally assault you and you'll get a role.
Oh, God. But I think it's, you know, the best emotional manipulators are the ones who don't know that they're doing it. You know, the people who just do it intuitively.
Naturally.
Yeah. And they can lie to themselves about it and reframe the story in their own heads. And that's why they're so convincing. And I often found that when I was, you know, posed as, you know, the anti-Islam, like hateful woman, you know, next to some, you know, very sweet hijabi who's very sad about how she's being treated and she's, you know, emoting a lot. And I would often feel like, oh, I'm being like, this is not a fair fight at all. You know, like this is not, it's as if I'm set up to fail. And no matter how strong my arguments are, no matter how right I am in this specific instance, here I'm this is just uneven terrain. And then, you know, I felt pressured to, you know, maybe I should be emoting a little bit more myself, you know, like maybe I should be putting on an act too, because I'm an ineffective activist because I can't do the full performance of, you know, victimization. I just present this like argument, and this is not how it works. I thought about that a lot in the case of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who's a very, like, I don't know if you've seen her in like an interview or anything, like when she's talking, but she's a very, you know, she's a very dignified kind of woman. She speaks in a very thoughtful way. She doesn't emote a lot in her face, actually, like at all. She's not a big emotional like person when she's on camera, but I actually have been in I've seen her interacting naturally, like outside of the camera, and she does emote just like a normal person. But I think she's, you know, when she goes on camera, she's this professional person who's giving her professional analysis of a situation. And I've often thought that that impacts her negatively, you know, like that is that if she really leaned on her, you know, ethnic background, her refugee status, the FGM thing, like rather than just telling the story, if she were to actually behave as if it happened, you know, people expect a certain kind of person, people expect a certain kind of demeanor, and she wasn't like putting it on, you know what I mean? But the people that were calling her hateful and whatever, like a far right bigot, whatever, they are putting on the airs, you know, like they'll walk in like an African dress and thing, and they're speaking in an accent that's not even their accent, and you know, and they get the upper hand because they're putting on the right performance. And
is that something that, sorry, that women activists do?
Yeah,
predominantly. Really well. Like, what's the male activist version of that?
I don't think men are good activists because they cannot do this effectively.
Oh, like, but they can't be like angry. I mean, but Ibram X. Kendi is an effective male activist.
There's a black.
So how is that
that can work
different? Yeah. But is he? But he's not.
He's angry. Not angry.
He comes
he's
across. He's an intellectual, but he's in a way doing the same thing that Ayaan is doing. But
I think men can be forgiven because we presume that if a woman is emotionally affected by something, that she will behave as if she is, you know, so there's a, we reward men for that stoic kind of like, you know, I'm an honorable man standing up in the face of injustice, and I refuse to be to bow down to it or to be emotionally affected by it. And that shows how strong I am. That works for men, you know, like,
yeah.
You can do that if you're a man. You can't really do that for a woman if you're a woman.
Yeah, well, I mean, sort of... women, but I think it's interesting what you're saying, because women's emotionalism, it's an effective tool. But I think you're right that if you don't, if you're a woman and you don't use that tool, you're kind of suspect.
Right.
I mean, I'm like thinking about the dog stuff. Well, I know. I mean, yeah. I'm thinking about, I mean, because people are going to be really mad at me about this dog thing. But I mean, I'm trying to think. You know, all the people online who were so upset about this, and there was even some, there was some discussion as to whether like Christy Noem's book editor secretly hated her, and that's why she was allowed to leave this part in the book. Like, nobody, of course, this is just going to be an absolute deal breaker for her in every way if you include this information. I mean, it was obviously, like, there were a lot of men on Twitter posting pictures of their dog. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it was a lot of women. And mm-hmm. it's just another example of leading by emotion. Like, yes, it's very upsetting. I didn't want to read the story. I was extremely upset by it. I didn't even look at it until like last night when we were getting ready. I didn't want to hear about it. It's awful. I am the most sensitive about animals, as you can imagine. I mean, mm-hmm. I am so much more sensitive about animals than I am about people. I drive down the street, and if there is like a trash bag, like on the side of the road, I avert my eyes because I'm so afraid it might be a dead dog or something like that. Like right now, there's a missing dog in neighborhood, mm-hmm. and the pictures are all over the, you know, these poor people are like desperate, and they put like posters all over the place, and there's this like big reward. And I'm so upset about it that I can't even look at the poster when I walk by. Like, I am the worst. But I still think that, like, you have to, at the end of the day, think about this in a rational way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would rather, honestly, I would challenge anyone to tell me that they would rather have their dog go missing and wonder for the rest of their lives if their dog is alive or dead, or if they would rather just have their dog be killed. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're making a rational case, you know, and I do. I agree with you. I agree. I think that what she did wasn't the best thing to do, but it wasn't out of, you know, it wasn't out of the bounds of like rational, responsible behavior, especially in the case of a farm. And but to be this kind of woman, this cruelty, you know, like when it is attached to a woman, is so damaging, you know, especially to a public.
I know. I wonder what a
servant. Yeah.
If a man had done that, if a man had written that in a book,
I don't think it'd be a news at all. I don't think the Guardian.
But what if it had been like the dog was really sick and it was suffering, and so I killed it. I mean, that goes on all the time. That's heroic.
Well, didn't Mitt Romney do something with the dog?
Mitt Romney put his Irish setter allegedly on the top of the car on a family vacation. I think I wrote about this at the time, although of course I can't remember what I said. But it's one of those things. He's a very big family, and the dog couldn't fit in the car. And it was one of those things that everybody ran away with this. And Mitt was like, no, you don't understand. Like, the dog loved it. Like, the dog, we had like a great like carrier for it. And it was like the wind was blowing in its hair, and it was safe, and it was better up there. I mean, I don't know. I knew a guy who used to take his dog paragliding.
Oh,
he had this incredible dog, and he, was a paraglider, was like super outdoorsy guy. And this was a rescue dog, actually, beautiful, pretty big dog. And the guy would like had a whole harness for her and would like, you know, put her in the thing, and he would like, you know, have her against his body, and they would go paragliding. And every time he got out the equipment, the dog would run, couldn't wait to get in the harness, couldn't wait to go up and do it, was so excited and loved it. So I don't know.
Dog loves it.
I'm not. So you just don't know. Please please don't get me wrong. I'm so sensitive about animals that it's almost like an impediment. Like I can't. I have to really avert my eyes.
Have you always been this way, or are you more this way now?
Always. Okay. Yeah, I have a whole piece about this in my book, The Unspeakable. Yeah, I'm very unsentimental about like everything, except that's this one thing, and I am so extremely sentimental that it's
all animals.
Yes,
chickens. Just those animals. Chickens who died. You're like, your heart is bleeding for those chickens.
Not as much, but no. I mean, I was so sensitive about animals that when I was a kid, if there was a children's book and if the animal was upset for 1 second or crying or if anything bad happened to an animal, even if it was going to be okay at the end, I would get so upset and my mother would have to like draw little smiley faces on the picture of the animal in the book because I just couldn't deal.
Aww.
It's yeah. So
that's
but I would say there's a connection between that and my willingness to euthanize my pets in due course. I thought,
because well, you're fully imagining their experience, you know. Yes, you're thinking fully about what's right. happening.
Yeah, people almost always do it too late, so euthanize early and often is my advice. And I plan to euthanize myself when the time
Megan
comes.
Stop saying that. You know,
I
what?
Only hope
you can,
that I can
you can live in my tiny
quality
apartment.
Of
you'll have to stay in the bathroom
the
whole time, but
I want you to tie me. I want you to, you know, chain me up to the radiator,
to the roof of
or the roof of your car.
To the roof of our car when we're going
on
family vacation.
It.
We don't have enough room for Megan, and she loves it up there.
Yeah,
that's what.
You know, it's either this or euthanasia. So
okay,
just, you know, call PETA. They'll sort it out.
All right, rate and review, please. Thank you. Nice things.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah. And see you next time.
See you next time. You have reached the end of the episode, which probably means you like our content. Why don't you join our Substack right now? You can become a paying subscriber at aspecialplace.substack.com. You can join our listener community, leave comments, interact with everybody. We'll see you in there. It is totally worth it. So please join us, aspecialplace.substack.com. And thanks for listening.